Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy. Recording is 3:08 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is April 8th. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with my central bank custom measure of central bank assets, and it's down to 32.5 trillion. So we've already seen that there's been in excess of 500 billion taken out of this measure in just the last month. And that's before we see that the pace of balance sheet runoff actually picks up. So it's also important to remember that this is a US dollar denominated index. So when the dollar is strong, it sucks liquidity out of the global economy. Everyone else's money is suddenly worth less. So even before we see meaningful interest rate hikes, even before we start to see balance sheet runoff starting, the very fact that the dollar remains firm and strengthening is already taking liquidity out of global balance sheets. And the pace with which that's going to take place is going to be much faster on this occasion than has been the case in other periods of quantitative tightening. So if we just look at the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, well, then we get, I think, some data to work with. The size of the Fed's balance sheet went down by about 75, excuse me, $750 billion between 2018 and 2019. And it caused a problem. So the first thing, of course, was that following the announcement, we had a 10% pullback. It coincided with the Federal Reserve beginning to raise rates, and subsequently then we had a new Fed governor. So those three things contributed to a 10% pullback. And then the market started to rebound because the Federal Reserve made some placating statements. But then, by the time we got to the end of 2018, when they had already taken out about 500 billion, the market pulled back by 20%. The Federal Reserve stopped raising rates. Within a quarter, they were already cutting rates. The size of the balance sheet started to expand again after the second quarter of 2019. And just like we've seen after every other period of quantitative tightening, because of the deflationary forces that quantitative tightening unleashes, the size of the balance sheets has subsequently needed to double. So then, of course, we had the catalyst of the pandemic, and the size of the balance sheet rocketed higher. But every time this has been attempted, whether in the EU or in the USA, we've seen the size of the balance sheet double. So now the Federal Reserve is going to try it again, and they anticipate taking $95 billion a month out of circulation. That's double the pace of quantitative tightening they attempted in 2018 and 19, and asset prices today are a multiple, at least, of where they were back then. So they're engaging in a more aggressive pace of tightening into an environment where asset prices are already high and valuations are rather aggressive, and it's understandably having a negative effect. Then, if we think about what we can see in terms of government bonds, well, government bond yields are surging higher, and this is quite normal. We have seen this in the past as well. When quantitative tightening is initially announced, bond yields rise. And they rise because the central bank isn't buying them anymore. So the market is suddenly bereft of the all-weather buyer, and then investors take flight and yields rise. So we're up to 2.7%, up another 4 basis points in here today. This is really an incredibly impressive acceleration. There have been occasions in the past where we've seen short-term overextensions in terms of the yield, but This has really been a profound advance, going from under 50 basis points in March of 2020 to 2.7 is a really incredible advance. And when we look at the total return of bonds, particularly here for the 10-year, we can even look at this on a log scale chart. Well, we've seen a very significant decline, coming down from a peak in August of about 2,500. We're at 2,200 right now. So that's an awfully big move in terms of the total return for what is supposed to be a steady asset. We can also think about this in terms of the return that's have been available from bonds, because we can see that the trend was a lot steeper back between 2000 and approximately 2012, and it went up from 700 to 2000. And in the intervening decade, from 2012 until now, it really hasn't. It's only gone up about 10%. So there's been a very significant slowing. But it's also worth reminding ourselves that there's only been one other occasion in the entire history of this index where the total return has traded below the 1,000-day moving average. That was back in 2018 and 19. And back then, yields were up around 3%. Now we're back below the 1,000-day moving average and continuing to extend the decline. So obviously, investors are beginning to think about whether this is the end of the bond bull market. And one thing that I think is relevant is it is normal for yields to surge after the beginning of quantitative tightening. But because the net effect of quantitative tightening is deflationary forces, then it's going to encourage dip buyers. And if growth starts to moderate, then investors are going to start to wade in and buy bonds. And there's no question that this isn't an accelerating trend. So eventually, we're going to start to see a dip buyer come in. It's just that there's no real sign of it yet, because we haven't really seen the knock-on effects of lower growth. We still have record high unemployment, excuse me, record high employment, and the jobless rate is still very low. We haven't really seen the knock-on effect of higher rates on consumer demand, but that's coming. The higher rates go, the greater the likelihood is it's going to have a knock-on effect in terms of demand. So when that happens, then bonds will start to catch a bid, and that's also going to help to resolve the negative outlook we have for stock markets. And it's the Nasdaq is now leading on the downside. I think it is particularly relevant that the Nasdaq has pulled back every day this week. It's now failing in the region of the 200-day moving average and the lower side of the overhead trading range. And it just looks like a downtrend overall. When we look at what the consistency of the trend was, it has continually found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average during the big pullbacks in the secular trend. Then it really accelerated, and it went from an approximation of the 200 of the 1,000-day moving average, excuse me, in March of 2020 to a very wide overextension. So it was more than 60% overextended relative to the 1,000-day moving average back in November. The trend up from the low in March of 2020 was particularly consistent. We had a sequence of ranges, one above another. They were also relatively similar sized, with an amplitude of approximately 2,000 points. And that was still true until approximately January of this year. The market could have found support in the region of the previous peak, but it didn't, and it broke downwards. And we had the initial leg lower, which was a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We've had the subsequent short covering rally, which was very powerful and certainly sucked in a lot of people. And now we're starting to see weakness coming back in again. And as long as we have central banks that are taking liquidity out of the system and talking about aggressively raising rates and aggressively reducing the size of their balance sheets, well, then this is going to, the Nasdaq is going to experience further trouble. What's particularly relevant right now is that investors are giving a premium to income and dividend growth. So the Dow Jones was in positive territory today. It didn't peak until January, and the Nasdaq peaked in November. And the dividend aristocrats are still quite steady. Now, this doesn't mean that they're going to be completely immune from selling pressure. But one thing that I find particularly relevant is when we think about how do bull markets end? Well, they end because central banks kill them off. Central banks assassinate bull markets. And that does appear to be what the Federal Reserve is keen to do right now. So we're starting to see that very much coming into focus for the Nasdaq, but it's coming into focus for the Nasdaq for a simple reason. It's where we've had the greatest emphasis on liquidity. So the only game in town since the beginning of 2009 has been liquidity. We've had round after round of quantitative easing, and each of them has been larger than the last. And every time there's a problem, we have central banks intervening and printing money in a fashion that was previously unimaginable. And the pandemic took it to another order of magnitude by also going big on the fiscal front. So then we had this huge move in terms of deficit spending. So this is the combined deficit spending of the major economies. It was at 2.3 trillion at the end of 2021, and now it's down to 1.84. But we're still running at extraordinarily high levels. And then I think it's interesting to look at money supply. So before 2020, it ranged in a pretty tight band, and any time it went above 10, it didn't really stay there for long. But then we had this profound move where money supply growth went to over 100% in March of 2020. And then it came down and it has stayed at the upper side of this range for a long time. And now it's really only starting to come down to about 4.7% on a month-over-month basis. Year-over-year, it's still in the region of 11%, but coming back down. So what we have right now is we have central bank balance sheets that are coming down. We have deficit spending that's coming down. We have money supply growth, which is coming down. We have financial conditions that are getting tighter. We have a dollar that's strengthening. And of course, the dollar is strengthening because there's less supply of new dollars. And the dollar is now up at the region of 100 on the dollar index and is still consistent on the upside. That's sucking liquidity out of everywhere else. What I find particularly interesting is the fact that China paid Russia in renminbi for oil and gas this week. And There is certainly an attempt underway to try and undermine the dominance of the dollar in the commodities markets. But one thing that's relevant and that hasn't really been discussed by people that are very eager to talk about the demise of the dollar as the reserve currency is that now the USA is a major exporter of commodities. So it's no longer simply a big consumer, but also one of the major exporters of oil and gas. And this is also an important point. Oil prices have been pausing around the $100 area. They were down to that area yesterday. They paused around it in here today. As an energy exporter, the USA benefits from somewhat higher prices. The last thing they want is prices to accelerate higher because that destroys demand. But if prices stop accelerating, then people start to adjust, and then revenues in terms of trade improve with higher commodity exports. And natural gas prices have, or at least are attempting, to break out of this long-term base formation. Somewhat colder weather in the western portion of the country has contributed to the higher prices of late, but we still do not yet have a fully fungible global natural gas price. It's coming. We're seeing a lot more investment in natural gas export and import facilities. So there is going to be a globally fungible price and market for natural gas eventually, and it does suggest that local disparities will be erased or certainly narrowed. But this does look like a bullish chart, and we've certainly had upside surprises coming through for lots of different commodities. So perhaps this is the turn for natural gas because it has first step above the base characteristics. But this is obviously a risk that we can miss the short-term risk because we're so focused on the long-term opportunity. So the long-term opportunity in commodities is that we're going to have a transformation in the global economy, that Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the atrocities that have taken place in there, are enough to shake Europe out of their somnolence and to really alert people to the risk from depending on a dictatorship for or almost completely for energy resources. So we can see what the future is, that Europe is going to endeavor to become energy independent. And that energy independence is going to become a central facet of the geopolitical global market environment for the next couple of decades. So obviously that puts enormous pressure on exporters like Russia or Saudi Arabia. But Russia is going one way in terms of trying to protect its markets. And going in and capturing the gas resources in the ground in eastern Ukraine has been their way of going about it. So we've seen just a profound slowdown in the Russian economy, and they're basically cutting themselves off from dealing with the Western world for the foreseeable future. At the other side of the spectrum, you have Saudi Arabia, who's trying to make friends internationally and is trying to modernize their economy and attracting inward investment and building out downstream manufacturing. And they are looking to become a manufacturing hub. They're looking to become more socially liberal. Now, that practically sounds like a contradiction in terms when you put it in the same sentence as Saudi Arabia. But the reality is that they've made huge strides. and perhaps don't get enough credit for what they've done already. But the stock market is certainly benefiting both from rising commodity prices and oil prices. We're in this environment where there is enormous promise, where we have a level of technological innovation that's mind-bending, and the pace with which quantum computing is improving is also mind-boggling. And the kinds of innovations that have taken place in chaos theory and artificial intelligence, deep learning. Now, a lot of these things, especially for artificial intelligence, tends to be hypish. But the kinds of innovations that are occurring in terms of chaos theory and predictions of chaotic events, those are real. And they're going to find their way into how the world works going forward. And this is going to be particularly interesting for autonomous vehicles, because in many respects, the volume of data that comes through from cameras around a car and the potential for real-world volatility to impact personal decisions, this is basically a chaotic type of environment. Now, of course, we're talking then about huge computing power to try and really get a handle on these kinds of problems. And in many respects, it takes a lot of money to have people working on them. But you really just need a small team of very smart people that can come up with viable solutions. So the pace of technological innovation will persist. There will, however, be a lot more competition for companies. So the IPO index continues to trend lower. Now, we had the big upside key reversal a month ago, and now we're starting to encounter resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And this sector, and I think it's equally true to lump in the SPAC sector and the innovation sector generally into this same basket. They're all going to experience type 3 bottoming characteristics, which means that we get the first counter trend rally, which will flush out the bears. Then we'll move into more of a ranging environment because people won't be willing to buy in size. They'll become more of a trader's market than a trending market, because a lot of these companies who are borrowing money to fund growth don't have any earnings. Well, the really good ideas, those that have the real potential to change how we live our lives and to both generate money and then also profits, well, they will succeed. But the business model where one goes for global domination immediately and goes for market share before any of your new competitors will basically flush you out, then that kind of business model isn't going to work anymore because there just won't be as much money going around. And private equity valuations have started to come down in a really profound way. So this is certainly leading on the downside. Now, one of the problems for companies like Amazon is most of its money and its profit potential doesn't come from selling stuff online. It comes from their web services division and basically selling rack space. So if small companies go bust and they can't all go for global domination at once, there just won't be as much demand for rack space. And that's going to contribute to lower growth. Now, obviously, we've had this incredible trend of digitization, and the digital trend isn't going to end. When we have inflationary pressures, people are going to put a premium on innovation and any kind of solution that will save them money and make them more efficient. And those types of business model will work. But the problem is that the number of companies that are offering IT consultancy has proliferated. Those that are offering rack space in data centers has proliferated. The number of data centers that have been built over the course of the last decade has been just nothing short of awesome. These are huge buildings and massive numbers of servers. And Amazon is pulling back in a dynamic manner from the lower side of its overhead range. It looks like a Type 3 top and a first step below it. So this again is another example of a trend that just does not look attractive. Well, Google and Microsoft have held up better than others, but Google was also down in a dynamic manner in here today. Now, Google has invested more than anyone else in R&D, and it has fingers in a lot of pies. So that's certainly one of the beneficial things behind it. But they've also spent a lot of money on data centers, and Microsoft has spent a lot of money on data centers. So if the innovation sector doesn't do well, well, then these types of companies are going to suffer. Now, they have the added benefit of having lots of other businesses that are income producing. So they probably have less downside potential than something like Amazon. Then we can think about some of the other companies that have really done spectacularly well in this environment. So Lululemon has convinced the world that wearing skin-tight leggings is a fashionable thing to do. And the share price has gone from 50 to nearly 500 in the space of 5 years. The one thing, though, that I think is particularly relevant is I got an email yesterday from my kids' school. They've opened a shop where kids can buy Lululemon school uniform outfits for a PE. I was talking with, I mentioned that to Mrs. Tracy. She said that everyone on her tennis team, everybody wears Lululemon. So this is an indication of Lululemon's success in gaining market dominance. But it also suggests that they've already got as much of the market as is possible. I haven't seen anybody else or any other sports brand that's successfully lobbied schools so that they can sell sports gear for their students. Therefore, where's the new growth going to come from? Because what they're selling is expensive. And in an environment where people don't have available cash, where growth is slowing, then the demand for high-priced gear isn't going to stay as strong. So this also looks susceptible to additional downside. So we can also think about the kinds of companies that supply chips to the big data centers, and Nvidia has certainly been one of those. What this is beginning to suggest to me is that the pace of innovation is unlikely to stop. But perhaps the cost of it will become more attractive. That there's going to be much more competition for smart minds and for really big solutions because the unavailability of cash is going to focus minds on profitability. But it means that the high valuations that have been attached to these sectors are going to start to come back down. And it's going to come down to how well companies have generated cash. So Tesla has now posted another big downward dynamic, and this is the third lower high. And it suggests to me that we're going to see at least a retest of the $800 area. And Tesla is one of the most actively traded stocks. So when options volume, put volume increases for Tesla, it's going to have a significant knock-on effect for options volume in the VIX. The VIX index is still right at the bottom of its range, but it's quite likely that it's going to pop higher from here. So if we go back then and try and answer the question, what do we anticipate in when bull markets end? Well, we've had an inverted yield curve for 3 or 4 days, and the yield curve then popped straight back up again. So it's now back around 20 basis points. And I anticipate that this is going to bob around a lot. But we've seen liquidity is becoming progressively more expensive and less available. And this has been a bull market that thrived on liquidity. Towards the end of bull markets, what you start to see is that the epicenter of risk peaks first. And that's what we're seeing now with the technology sector. It's peaking first. Then we have to pay attention to banks, because banking sectors are also pulling back. And it hasn't really been relevant to pay attention to banks for most of the last decade. They haven't been the best performers. They haven't generally been the worst performers. But banks are liquidity providers. And when liquidity is less available, they don't perform as well. So the S&P 500 banks encountered resistance last week in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now it's off the lows in here today. And then, of course, we have this big question. Is what's happening in the USA really that important? Are we going to see tightening everywhere else as well? But certainly, we're starting to see that banks are underperforming and technology is underperforming. And commodities are really doing very well. And commodities generally tend to be very pro-cyclical. So the LME Metals Index has accelerated up to the 5,500 level and is now consolidating. Copper prices have been ranging for a year and are still steady below the 500 level, but they're not breaking out either. Oil prices are back in the region of the 100 level. We've had a great deal of volatility in commodities like nickel. And nickel prices are still hovering here around the 38,000 level. And that's really not all that far away from where we've seen prices starting to ramp higher in 2007 and come back down again. There's been a very brief period where they've traded above this level in the past. So it looks like at least a peak of near-term significance. So we've had really impressive moves higher from commodity producers. BHP, as both an energy and iron ore producer, continues to be very firm and is completing, or really has broken out of what is effectively a decade-long range. Rio Tinto has successfully marketed itself as the ESG miner, and it's also consolidating above the previous peak. Glencore has been one of the few companies that has said they're going to hold on to their assets in Russia, and it's been concentrating on making money. So the share has also broken out of a decade-long range and is coming back into the region of the original IPO level. We can think about the really impressive advance we've seen in the lithium sector. And lithium prices are up in a big way, and Allkem pushed up and out of its range before pausing in here this week. We're also starting to see that commodity-related currencies are also strengthening. So the Brazilian real has completed its base formation, and it's trading above the 1,000-day moving average for the first time in more than a decade. So commodity producers do well in this kind of environment. And we're starting to see the kind of change of hands that we saw in the early 2000s, where technology had been the only place to be, and then commodities started to take off. But commodities started to take off because there was an supply inelasticity, because there hadn't been any investment in commodities for a long time. And then there was a jump in demand following the introduction of China into the World Trade Organization. So that was a really big event, and it contributed to a phenomenally large commodity bull market that lasted for a decade. And in that time, all commodities did well, and gold in particular captured the imagination of investors. And gold prices continue to consolidate here around the $1,900 area. And it just looks like a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. We're in an odd situation right now where both the dollar and commodities are rallying at the same time. And this is quite different to what we had in the early 2000s. I don't think, though, that anyone is really convinced that the dollar is going to remain the strongest currency in the world indefinitely. So we're seeing a big transition occurring right now because of higher yields. And this is sort of, I think, where there's a blend of lots of different themes coming through. So we know what happens when we get quantitative tightening. Yields go up first because there's a loss of a buyer. But then buyers start to come back in because growth deteriorates. And then yields start to come back down. And when yields come back down, it also contributes to the central bank relenting and cutting interest rates. And then that's when new bull markets start. So this is a big medium-term correction, but it's not even close to over. Historically, when we see growth starting to moderate, well, commodities do well heading into that because we haven't had growth moderating yet. And monetary conditions are still, they're tightening, but they're not very tight. So there's still a lot of speculation. And there's a lot of enthusiasm that we're going to have to build a great deal of infrastructure to try and do without energy from Russia. So that's helping to support the outlook for the solar sector. But even solar to this week had a downside key reversal. One of the challenges for the sector is that some of the business models are very interest rate sensitive and others aren't. And then that feeds through into how investors perceive the entire sector. So, for example, NextEra Energy is one of the biggest utilities in the USA, and they've invested heavily in wind and solar. So, those are income producing assets. Then you have companies like Sunrun. And Sunrun is a company which is very interest rate sensitive because they have to carry a note between when they put the solar panels on people's homes and when they're eventually paid off. And that means that they're exceptionally exposed to higher short-term interest rates. So that share is starting to come back down again. Generally, we see commodities go on a really strong run, but they're definitely not the lead indicators for future trouble. Instead, what we anticipate is that it's banks and technology and interest rate sensitive portions of the market do worst first, and then they drag everything else down afterwards. It's when the defensive sector is the best performing sector that we need to pay particular attention to the worst performers. So, dividend aristocrats being by far the steadiest portion of the market, that's a warning shot that we're looking at the potential for significant trouble in stock markets. Because the most levered portion of the market is uniquely interest rate sensitive. And the reintroduction of a discount rate is really bad news for fancy valuations. Now, it would be easy then to conclude that we should be extra cautious. But what we're seeing out of Japan and Europe and China suggests that there's going to be more liquidity produced. So, first, let's think about what is Europe doing. If we look at the 10-year Bund, yields are rising, and that's going to have a material impact on Germany's cost of funding. Yields are up to 70 basis points. 6 months ago, they were still in sharply negative territory, and yields now are back in the region of where they were in 2018. So Germany's finally going to have to start paying to borrow money, but it's still at a very low rate. But then we can think about Italian yields. If we then think about the inter company or the inter sovereign spreads in Europe. The ECB announced today that they've put a mechanism in place to ensure that spreads don't get out of control. So it's not technically yield curve control because they're not targeting the yield curve, they're targeting spreads. And they're trying to stop these spreads moving higher just by saying that they're going to stop it from happening. But even though we had this announcement from the ECB today, it did not stop Italian spreads from widening. Now, the upper side of this base formation is probably around the 2.5% level, and I think 200 basis points is going to be a big point of potential resistance. But it does look likely that it's going to be tested. And then the Spanish sovereign bonds, these aren't quite as high, but they are, I think, starting to move as well. So we've definitely seen that the Italian yields are leading on the upside, and the Spanish yields are beginning to play catch up. And I think this is largely inevitable. I'm not sure at all that this is the correct the correct chart, but I did look at it earlier, and I'm pretty sure that the upper side of the base is around 100 basis points. When we think then about what's going on in Japan, Japan is defending the 10-year yield and ensuring that it doesn't go above 25 basis points. That's creating a belly in the curve. We can clearly see here that the trend line should be going straight, but it's starting to create this belly in the curve. So we're seeing that the 9-year yield is rising and the 15-year yield is rising, but the 10-year yield is being held downwards. So it's creating this butterfly or barbell effect in the yield curve. It's basically going to artificially create a dip or a belly in the curve, which obviously is going to help the funding costs of the Bank of Japan, but it's also something that's going to ensure that there's plenty of liquidity. Now, we can pay attention to the fact that the euro remains quite weak and trending downwards in a consistent manner. And the yen is quoted the other way around, but it's still trending higher. And then we can think about China. So the Chinese administration are spending money to ensure that the renminbi doesn't move very far. But it's worth reminding ourselves that they're holding it steady versus the US dollar, but the euro is trending downwards against it. And when we look at China's foreign reserves, and hopefully this is updated, we can see that China's spending money. So their reserves have been coming down since the beginning of this year. Reserves really haven't gone anywhere for most of the last 5 years. So this long-term period where they were accumulating reserves is pretty much over. And if they are going to continue to support the currency, then and simultaneously try to support the economy through greater stimulus, well, then that means that the renminbi has to weaken. So they don't want to weaken the currency. They want to try and hold it steady because they're trying to encourage other countries to accept renminbi. But the downward pressure that we're starting to get from the lockdowns in China, particularly in Shanghai and Jilin, and the cost in terms of productive capacity of locking down the whole country to ensure that the latest round of coronavirus doesn't infect the whole country. Well, that's obviously something that's really weighing on China. Now, obviously, they haven't had the same inflationary pressures as everyone else because they didn't print as much money. But the stimulus or the potential for stimulus is certainly improving. And we are starting to see that the property sector in Hong Kong has been recovering. So I think investors are willing to bet that we're coming to the end of this really significant period where there's been a lot of pressure on the real estate sector. They've really tried to snuff out speculation in home builders. But that also suggests that if China is willing to declare victory on its attempts to snuff out speculation, then they will print more money. So we have Japan that's continuing to produce liquidity. And we have Europe that is trying to talk the market down from increasing spreads on peripheral bonds over bunds. And we have China, which has this problem with slowing growth because they basically instituted it themselves. And now they're dealing with the coronavirus on top of that. So it's increasingly likely that they will have to provide additional stimulus. And they're all contending with the strength of the US dollar, which is devaluing their respective currencies. It's making imports more expensive. So this is obviously a challenge for their domestic economies. In normal circumstances, they wouldn't be cutting rates or they wouldn't be making more liquidity available. So we're in an odd situation where the ECB is probably going to have to try and raise rates while at the same time making liquidity available. It means that they're going to be extremely cautious about raising rates. Japan has basically said they're not going to raise rates. They're going to let everyone else do it first. They've been trying to create inflation for decades, and they must view this as their last one big good opportunity to reignite inflationary pressures. And even then, companies don't feel confident enough to raise prices in Japan. So until that happens, they won't declare victory over inflation. And then, of course, there's what's going to happen with China. So we're in an interesting situation. Europe has to build more infrastructure. The USA has already passed their infrastructure bill. So they're going to spend at least $750 billion and probably more than that on new infrastructure. And companies like Plug Power, which is a hydrogen and battery producer, rebounded impressively over the last week, but then had the big downside weekly key reversal in here this week. So even when we think about infrastructure development, the main beneficiaries are the commodity producers, the innovation portion of the market, which sees the growth and sees that there's going to have to be demand for more plug-in. There's more, I guess, recharging facilities because of all the new new charging facilities because of all the electric vehicles that are going to be built. They're still pulling back right now because they're interest rate sensitive and they demand their everything at the moment is being painted with the same brush. Where we're definitely seeing more interest coming through is in the biotechnology sector. So Vertex is the kind of company, and Regeneron is the kind of company where you have both growth and revenue. And it's these kinds of companies are attracting interest because investors are not willing to give the benefit of the doubt to growth in the future. They want growth now and revenue now. So healthcare is doing well. And it's not just the big biotech companies, but the S&P 500 healthcare sector has also broken on the upside in here this week. But these are very defensive. And utilities, which are clearly a play on higher rates, have also broken on the upside. Now, these are exceptionally defensive sectors. And when very defensive sectors do this well against a background of a stock market which is under significant pressure, and the semiconductors index, which has first step below the peak characteristics, we have to conclude that we're late in the cycle. And eventually, the underperformance of technology will drag the wider stock market down. We have central banks like Europe and Japan and China who have the potential to create liquidity, but they're going to have to be cautious about it. And it's that caution is contributing to just this lack of interest in speculation. And what that also suggests is that this significant potential medium-term demand for commodities might contribute to short-term volatility. We're obviously going to have to see more money poured into alternatives to Russian oil and gas. That's going to happen one way or the other. And there's going to be a lot of infrastructure built as a result. There is huge money being poured into building new factories for well, first for semiconductors, but also for batteries. That represents a massive demand driver for all of the big industrial metals relating to renewable energy, like copper, lithium, and nickel. And then, of course, we have steel. So every one of those skyscraper-sized wind turbines requires massive amounts of steel. So these kinds of companies that have been doing exceptionally well recently, they're not going to be immune from the wider stock market going down. And the weaker the Nasdaq gets, then the greater the pressure that's going to come to bear on the wider market. The total return of, or I guess the market cap of the Fangman plus Tesla shares has pulled back again It's still above the 200-day moving average, but it has failed to break upwards out of this range that's been forming for the last year. And I think it's relevant that if we just simply look at the market cap of those eight companies, it has a striking resemblance to the NASDAQ. So I think it's reasonable to anticipate that we're going to see a full unwind towards the 1,000-day moving average, that we'll have a hiccup in perhaps the commodity complex, and that'll create a buying opportunity for the massive amount of infrastructure development that's going to happen over the next decade. It's going to become progressively more difficult to get money for innovation companies, and that's going to create a huge amount of competition within that sector for what is the available cash. One of the biggest problems for pension funds is this massive move in yields is disastrous for the 60-40 portfolio. If you're holding 40% of your bonds, of your portfolio in bonds, then it's very hard to avoid significant distress, which is why the 3-month yield has been reasonably contained. But it is now starting to move higher, and I suspect it's going to be at 1% within the next couple of weeks because it's pricing in the reality that the Fed is seriously talking about a 50 basis point hike. With a 20% pullback to the region of the 1,000-day moving average on the NASDAQ, I would anticipate that the Federal Reserve will relent and that we'll start to see more money becoming available. But we're just not there yet. So we're definitely in a medium-term correction, and it's more likely than not that it's not over and that it will not end until central banks come out, perhaps in a unified fashion, and say that they're going to move in and start to support growth, that the negative consequences of balance sheet tightening and quantitative tightening overall are more worrisome in terms of deflation than the inflation that we see at present. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.